Hello and welcome to Blue Sky Horse Radio. Today is the 9th of October and thank you for listening. This is soundfm.ca, or if you happen to be in Kitchener-Waterloo here in Ontario, you can listen in at 100.3 FM. And I'm really excited today because I have a very special guest, actually. Her name is Elise Harding Davis, and she's based in Windsor, and I'm going to call her up on the phone right away because she's going to go live with us, and we're calling her live. She'll do the introduction of herself. She's the best person to do that, so.
Hello.
Hi, Elise. How are you doing today? This is Jennifer from Blue Sky Horse Radio. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jennifer. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing really well. So, yeah, I just gave a little quick introduction, but I believe that you're the best person to introduce yourself. Do you want to say something about who you are for the listeners?
Well, these days I call myself an African-Canadian heritage consultant. I've been involved in promoting and preserving Black heritage for, gosh, well over 50 years. Curator Administrator of the North American Black Historical Museum in Abbotsford, now the Abbotsford Freedom Museum, for 32 years. And it's just a passion of mine, being a seventh generation African Canadian. I'm very, very concerned, especially about our cemeteries, and with the help of a few other friends, including Glenn Cook, we've preserved 13 so far.
Wow, that's incredible. And I have been to one of the cemeteries that you helped preserve, and I didn't realize you were involved with that many, although I knew you were involved with quite a few.
Well, that's how we met.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Did you want to tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, that particular cemetery is the Peace River Black Community Cemetery site, and Glenn knew that it was a family site for his family, being buried there from the time he was a young boy, but it was overgrown, and so he basically rediscovered it and contacted me to talk about ways to preserve it and whatnot, and as a result of that, in 2007, that cemetery site received the Ontario Heritage Trust, a provincial preservation designation, which is pretty prestigious, and then Glenn got the Order of Ontario for his work on that site. So African Canadian cemeteries, and they're all very precarious. There's no real tangible evidence that African Canadians were here in Canada as early as they were and in the numbers that they were. They want to cap things at 40,000 possibly who tried, and then some made it of that. But there were far more, Jennifer, and my goal is to improve knowledge on our history.
Very good. So regarding this cemetery here, like, how come it would be at risk to begin with?
Well, most of our settlements were in more rural or isolated areas. Two reasons for that. One, we wanted to protect ourselves. As former slaves, many people did not want to be around European people because they feared what would happen to them. Number two, European people did not necessarily want Black people close to them, and so we were often given areas that were not ideal, but worked for us. The Peace River Black Community Cemetery is in Maidstone, Ontario, which was an early Black settlement area. And among the people buried in that cemetery, there's one marker left, and it reads, Lewis Jackson, born a slave in Kentucky. And then it gives his date of death, and on the other side of it is listed to his wife Mary, who had also been a slave. And around the base of it are small little block markers that represent the children they had who did live to adulthood. And it's a whole story in itself. It's so intriguing to read Cemetery Gravestones. It's something I've done since I was a little girl. It's almost like I was destined to be who I am. And these sites are, well, in particular, there's another site down the road, Duke's Memorial Cemetery. And it is boundaried by the Puce River. And these days, there's a subdivision behind it. And we're not sure if it was ever looked into as to whether the true boundaries are existing and whether or not houses are being built on cemeteries. These are the kind of things that we really have to worry about. Roads get widened. That happened to the Buse Memorial as well. And 30 feet at the front of the site were lost. So there could be people under the tarmac.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I visited down there, and we went to the Puce community, the Black Community Cemetery first, and then you took us up the road a bit, and we saw, for example, the name of the cemetery was sort of like shuffled to the side in what looked like to be a dump.
That's right. They had taken down their original old wooden crossbeam marker and shoved it back to the back of the site. And, you know, it's hurtful, and it's also very dangerous because it diminishes our importance in society as well. People don't have enough respect to honor our site. One such site was in Harrow, Ontario, where I live, and I fought for over 40 years to have that designated municipally. When I first moved to Harrow, when they had the Harrow Fair, which is a renowned fair, people come from all over the place, they would park cars on it for overflow parking. I couldn't stand it. It hurt me to my heart to see broken markers piled up against a tree, rubbish on the ground, no care being given to it, and cars being parked there while people were having fun. There's a white cemetery, a Baptist cemetery, just down the road, and nobody ever parked them in.
No.
So, you know, I'm not pointing fingers at any person in particular, but I am thinking that societal systemic thinking has diminished African-Canadian, or for that matter, Black people's history and holdings, and that's why it's so important to me to make sure these cemeteries are protected.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. And there's so much to talk about, Elise, and I'm so happy that you're here. We also went to the museum in Amherstburg, because when you sent me your curriculum vitae the other day, I was like, my jaw dropped, because I know you a fair bit, and I've Googled you, and there's lots of information to read about you on the internet, and news reports, and well, you've been on TV, you've been in newspapers, and really, there's so much to touch on. And the museum in Amherstburg, for people that maybe don't know, Amherstburg was an entry point for people that were coming with the Underground Railroad.
Right.
And they landed often in Amherstburg.
That's right. And thousands of Black people traveled through Amherstburg as far as Oro, Owen Sound in northern Ontario, and on into Quebec as well.
Wow, that's quite the extensive network.
That's correct. And, you know, old big families like mine, who were in Amherstburg and Owen Sound and Quebec, were very well connected. We had organizations like the Prince Hall Masonic Lodge, which was the oldest land-based lodge in North America, dating back to the late 1700s. When King George III's son gave gives them the charter to become a lodge. All the British lodges were camp lodges because they were here for the War of Independence to fight, but they were not settled. So, you know, we had organizational skills. We took care of each other because nobody else would. We had to learn so much about society because many of us as slaves were not allowed to read and write formally. We're not allowed to present ourselves in society with any kind of polish. And so these small communities were microcosms of the larger world. We wanted our children to be able to function in society just like all of the other cultures, and to have proper homes, proper education, and a spiritual connection that helps us take care of each other. And that's what we did.
Yeah.
You know, we did I was partnered with another gentleman named Ken Turner. He's white, and he had a real love of cemeteries, period, as I did myself. And he decided to do an amateur archaeological dig at a site near Kingsville, Ontario, where black people had been located, coming in, some of them, as United Empire loyalists. And all we found, but fortunately we did find, the base of a grave marker on a site that had been the Shiloh Baptist Church. And we put up a marker. I had the privilege of writing the story about the people who had come in as pioneers on one side, and on the other side, we listed their lots and concessions and property holdings. But when anybody who goes there, researching their own family, can find out where they lived, and that gives people a huge leg up when they're doing genealogical research.
Mm-hmm.
And on the very base of it, I had carved that it is chiseled in stone. Because that phrase comes from Greek times, when slave masters would take their slaves to Mount Olympus and have rocks chiseled with their freedom on them. When I visited Mount Olympus, I took pictures of that because it's so poignant to me that it is chiseled in stone that they were free.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, in this day and time, and I'm going to say with the election process that's going on in the United States, a lot of racism has reared its ugly head.
Yeah.
It isn't dead. It's a living animal. And we in Canada may be more fortunate, but we still have to be vigilant. Because our part in Canadian history has not been dealt with properly, in my opinion. That's why I am writing books. I wrote a book on the War of 1812, discussing the black involvement and also trying to help people understand there's always been a controversy. Who won that war? Blacks, whites, English, British, French, Americans? Who won it? Well, nobody feels that anybody won it, with the exception of myself. I feel blacks won it, because over 4,000 blacks fought with the British, either escaping from their masters or as free blacks joining the British Army. They were given property here in Canada. There's a long story behind that, too. But they had the ability to contact loved ones and former friends in the United States to help them know that there was freedom here in Canada, even though there was slavery in Canada in the 1780s and 90s. But we had the opportunity to settle unmolested.
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah.
We didn't wait for freedom. We took our freedom ourselves. We got up and walked away from it. My own great-grandfather was born in 1823 in Missouri, and he was a slave master's son. When he turned 21, he received his manumission papers, which was a form of a freedom paper. And he walked from Missouri to Detroit, Michigan, sold fish for 4 years, then walked back to Missouri and bought his wife and his four oldest children from their grandfather.
Wow.
Then they walked back to Detroit, crossed the Detroit River in the wintertime, stayed on Belle Isle for a short time, then walked across the southern portion of Lake St. Clair, also frozen, and settled in Dresden, Ontario, where he had the only stagecoach line servicing southwestern Ontario. So he was an entrepreneur. He went from being born a slave to having his own company.
Wow.
So, you know, that gives people a different mindset. It's like Europeans coming here, say from Ireland during the potato famine, and they weren't welcomed either. And coming into a country against all odds and succeeding, well, we have very similar stories, but nobody's told them. That's what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And with the help of people like Ken and Glenn, it's easier and it's more comfortable than doing it on my own. Mm-hmm. Although I would, I have no problem with that.
Absolutely.
And because of my passion for Black history, I have traveled all over the world. I have been to China and Africa, Greece, Portugal, Spain, England, most of the United States, the continental United States, all of the Canadian provinces, and most of the Caribbean. I have had a wonderful life to this point, and I feel that I am doing important work.
Yeah, you certainly are.
I'm so thrilled to have an opportunity whenever one presents itself, and thank you so much for inviting me on the show, because sometimes people need to hear what's going on with others in order to start to develop an understanding that this multicultural world is peopled with multicultural people.
Yeah.
And you yourself, coming from a different country into Canada, you have to adjust. People have to adjust to you. And sometimes you're accepted right away, and sometimes you're not. Well, we've been dealing with this for 500 years, and this is my country.
Yeah.
I am more Canadian than many, many people, and I'm still asked where I come from.
Yeah.
And so I tell people. And, you know, I've gotten past being angry and hurt. That happened years and years ago. There are no stupid questions, and I give the best answer I can. People need to be able to communicate with each other and openly discuss their differences and their similarities. All of this ISIS business is a result of people not talking to each other, people assuming things. And that's been done with Black people for centuries. We're not lazy, we're not ignorant, we're not poor, we're not on welfare. We are contributing members and pioneering people of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've written another book that is called The Colors of Essex County, and it deals with 13 Black cemeteries in Essex County alone. And since writing the book, I've heard from probably 8 more individuals talking about Black cemetery sites. Well, I'm on that because the more I know about, the better people will understand, as I said earlier in this conversation, about the larger numbers of people one cemetery on Walker Road, and I certainly didn't get a chance to drive you by. There's only one marker there, but we figure there were at least 500 people buried in that site.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so, you know, multiply that. No cemetery sites were church reserve property, and they were 5 acres in size. None of the cemeteries you saw were 5 acres or even close to it.
No.
But some of them had churches on them. Some of them had settlements on them of religious people. If I don't help preserve these, who's going to know?
Exactly.
I honestly feel it's my duty, and to me, it's a loving responsibility. And I've learned so much. Each and every site has prominent people involved with it who've done miraculous things after either coming to Canada themselves or being the children of former refugees. Mm-hmm. And I call Black people refugees, not fugitives, because they weren't running from crimes they committed. They were running from crimes that were committed against them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Absolutely.
Kosovo, Romania, places like that that have had wars, most people are given refugee status. We never got that status. We weren't even offered Canadian citizenship until 1911.
Wow.
Yeah,
so,
that's...
You know, it makes you realize a whole different part of history, and it enriches you. And I tell university graduates, professors, you didn't get a proper education. Without Black history, all of history is incomplete.
Yeah.
I 100% agree with you. I was going to just say that. Sorry.
There's another programmer in the studio with me, and he's just nodding and saying that he agrees with you. And, yeah. It's the victors that write the history, right? And sometimes, yeah, but it's so important. And when I was reading your book, the one that you wrote on the War of 1812 and the unsung military volunteers who were the Blacks, and there's part of your book where you talk about how they changed the law, like the way that the law was interpreted in England allowed for slavery.
Correct.
Do you want to talk a bit about that? Because that's fascinating to me.
Yes. Well, you know, Great Britain was an enormous slaver, meaning they went to Africa, stole Black people, took them across the high seas, world and to Britain, and enslaves them. Now, the particular case that you're talking about, I'm looking it up right now, a Black man claimed his freedom in Britain because on the books there was never any legal slavery in Great Britain. It was just a common custom that was adapted because it was profitable. And they fought against this, and actually he won his case. And that started the abolition movement in Great Britain. Many, many escaped slaves, including Frederick Douglass, went to Great Britain to plead our case. And thousands and thousands of dollars and thousands of people supported abolition. And that's how it came about in 1833. And it was enacted 1st of August, 1834, which is the Emancipation Celebration for all the British subjects around the world, not just Canadian Blacks, not just American Blacks, but people from India, bond servants who were white and enslaved in all the different countries that Great Britain ruled. And I might add that the slave owners at that time were given reparations. isn't it? See them before I die.
Yeah, I know. I've thought of that too. And it's sort of, the powers want us to forget the history and the distant history, but, I mean, it's still alive because things haven't changed all that much, and like you were saying about racism, you know, things may have happened in the past, but we can still see the remnants of it, and some of it is very strong still today.
That's right. You know, speaking about enslavement, our Aboriginal brothers and sisters were enslaved right along with us in their own natural country. They were here before the rest of us, and the things that are happening with them today are atrocious. It's sinful that Aboriginal women are disappearing and nobody's doing anything about it. I'm a big advocate of women's rights too, because as a black woman, I've experienced a bit of prejudice. Not a lot, because I don't dignify it, but it's certainly been offered up to me. You know, when I was a young girl downtown Windsor, where I lived, I went into our local store that had women's clothing, and I stood at the counter and I waited and I waited. There was no one else in there, and then some women came in and they were waited on, and I'm still standing there. And I left.
Yeah.
Well, I went home and I told my mom and dad what had happened. My father made me get in his truck. Was an electrical contractor. He took me back to the store and he said, you go on in there and you get waited on. He says, don't make a fuss, but you get waited on. So I went back in and the woman noticed me, the same lady who had been there when I was in there previously, and she said, weren't you in here before? She said, yeah, and I said to her, yes, I was in here before and I was waiting to get waited on, just like I am now. And I would like to try on a bra. That was embarrassing enough for me.
Yeah.
And she said, well, you know, you can't return them. And I said, yes, I'm aware of that. Does that apply to everybody? And she looked at me and she blushed and she says, come on, and I'll help you try some on and get the proper size for you. And I said, thank you very much. And I bought a bra. I went outside, got back in the truck. My father made me return it. And he said, if you tell them, if they don't wait on you properly, our money spends like everybody else's, and you're not going to spend it there. So that was a valuable lesson.
Yeah.
You don't take being prejudiced against. You deal with it in a dignified manner, because you're helping all the other people who are coming in there behind you, and you're also helping business people understand that they have a benefit in helping different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Like with my dad's business, as I said, he was an electrical contractor. He was a veteran, a wounded veteran of the Second World War, and when he came back, he got his electrical contractor's papers.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of his work was for the Jewish community, the Oriental community, the East Indian community that was coming into Canada at that time, because other contractors didn't want to work for them, which was to my dad's benefit.
Yeah.
And he had a wonderful business for over 42 years, and he even did repairs on the apartment buildings. So, you know, that's how I grew up. That's what I saw. That's what I was a part of. So obviously, I come from people who fight. Obviously, I come from people who succeed. I don't know how well I've done at the second one, but I certainly am a fighter.
Well, based on your curriculum vitae, you've succeeded really well, because it's a long document and everything. You know, including National Film Board of Canada, you have a very diverse background, actually, of what you do.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate, because I don't know if I stick out or I have accomplished to the level that I am contacted to do things, and I always jump at the chance. When watch everyone else and not see myself reflected. Mm-hmm. I went through that in school. When I was in university, my professor, when we got to the Civil War, that era, the 1850s, 1860s, by the way, there was an underground railroad, is where black people skate. And if you want to know about it, go to Detroit, that's where it ended. I put my hand up and he says, oh, at least not again, because I was always putting my hand up. I said, sir, I'm a product of the Underground Railroad. Part of my family used that process to gain their freedom. And he looked at me and said, you know, you're just full of trivia, aren't you? And I got up and walked down to the dean's office and quit. because I was not going to pay for an education that didn't include me.
Yeah.
Again, I went home and I told my mom and dad, and my father tore a strip off of me. He said, first of all, you're not paying for anything. I am. Secondly, what are you going to do without an education? You have to have papers in order to, quote, quote, be somebody in this world. He said, you're a black girl. You're going to have to do twice as much to get half as much. And then he got up and he hugged me, and he said, I am so proud of you. For standing up for what you know is right. He says, but I'm also putting on you the responsibility of making sure other people know about it. I had no idea that I would be the curator of a museum, let alone all the other things that have happened since then. You know, it's magic. Absolute magic.
Yeah, from the sounds of it.
Well, I don't care who you are, even yourself. If you believe in something and you keep pushing for it, you can make it happen. Maybe not all at the same time, but bit by bit, you can create change. And that's what life's all about, Jennifer. You know, we can be very insecure in our own insides. But if we have a belief, get out there and work for it and make it happen. That's all I'm doing. And I guess maybe that is known and it's seen and it works.
Yeah.
I went from going to school with trunk full of books, distributing information about black. When I worked in the hospital, my goal was to have all infants, particularly black infants, tested for sickle cell anemia. But sickle cell anemia is a black-oriented disease that is prominent not only in Africa, but in Europe, places like Greece, Turkey, and in India, where any of the more Asian patients happen, and in France, you will find sickle cell anemia, and it's a serious disease. And thank God, they now test babies for it. I was the first black executive administrator of a hospital in this region, a hospital that I was born in. A hospital that had refused my parents entry with a sick brother because they owed them so much money. My brother would spend entire years in the hospital. He got thousands of blood transfusions. And my parents overcame that. So I had good role models. Very good role models. And they gave me my history. They knew about their own history. And allowed me to be myself. You know, they didn't say, you're going to be a doctor or you're going to be a nurse. You're going to do what I tell you. They never did that with me. And I've never done that with my own children or my grandchildren. But I tell them, and hopefully they listen, I feel that they do. And I've had the opportunity to talk to, I'm going to say, hundreds of thousands of people, to be very honest.
Wow.
When I was in Africa, I taught over 2,000 students. about the portion of Black history they didn't know about after leaving their community being stolen and transported to the New World. I talked to them about slavery, then I talked to them about Underground Railroad, and I talked to them about the freedom that Black people enjoy, and they were very impressed with that. And they called me the Black White Woman. because obviously I'm mixed, which I am. And I was there with a group of Rotarians, and one teacher, the teachers had been banned by, in the classroom, by the way, while I talked to the students. And some of them were hanging around outside the windows. One male teacher in particular, when I came out of the room, had been listening, and he had tears in his eyes, and he said to me, "Those white people let you talk like that? You're very strong in your convictions, and you talk about such glorious triumphs for Black people." I said, "Nobody lets me or stops me from saying anything, sir." He says, "I've never met anybody like you." He says, "You're telling a story that none of us know about. We only have in our history how members of our family, people from this village, were stolen long ago, never to return. We never knew what happened to them." I said, "Well, you know what? I learned something here a few days ago on a tour we took. We went to Cape Coast, which was a slave factory, and we visited a little community. And the interpreter there was talking about the chief in Ghana in the 16, 1700s. They were called Guyan, G-U-Y-A-N-S. And my mouth fell open, and I said to this teacher, "In my family, Guyan is a generational family name. We never knew where it came from. Maybe this is where we came from."
Wow.
Yeah, you know, it gives me chills.
Yeah.
So many times things like that have happened, and all it does is encourage me to keep doing what I'm doing, because I know it's right. I know that Black history is equivalent to any other history. I'm not trying to make it more important. I'm trying to make it as important, to give it its proper place. It has to all be linked together.
Yeah. Good. Well, from the sounds of it, so you've been really productive with your writing too. So you're writing your fourth book, and you were saying before that it's going to be you're sending it off next week
to be printed.
Exciting. So the third book then, what is the topic on that one?
That was about a woman by the name of Esther Mallaby Banks. It's featured around the Banks log cabin, which a friend, Chris Carter, and I had installed at Heritage Village in Essex County here, that Esther Mallaby Banks was born in Annisburg in 1813. Her mother was a Ghanaian princess, and her father, by Banks family lore, was General Brock. And through research, we have found documentation that Brock was in Annisburg the day she was born, and he sent a bottle of wine up to the mother, and he also had a christening gown made for the baby. Unfortunately, he died at Queenston Heights. Who knows what could have come of that?
Mm-hmm.
Esther Mallaby was blonde with blue eyes, very fair. How does a Ghanaian princess have a child like that by a Black father?
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, I tell people, look behind what you hear. An example is little Black lawn jockeys that people used to have on their lawns with the lanterns. During the Underground Railroad era, Black children risked their lives go up to the end of lanes or the edge of fields with those lanterns to stick help to escaping slaves, that this was a safe place for them to come to get some rest and some food. During the 1960s, friends of mine used to go around and shoot those ganja trees in people's yards because they felt insulted that they would have these little blackface caricatures on their property. To us at the time, it signified that they degraded us. But the true story is a wonderful story and a courageous story and a bold story of black children risking their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the things that are important to me, Jennifer.
Yeah, they're important to me too. Because we're all part of this big picture, really, and just like you were saying about the cemetery and the evidence that it makes up that these places get to be maintained. Even when I went to the museum down there, you have such an amazing place at Amherstburg Freedom Museum there. And I was just thinking to myself that you can see that maybe there are not any grants coming from the government to make sure that everything is just being well protected. And because a lot of museums, when you go in there, you can feel everything is behind thick glass and everything sits way away because I guess they get grants from the government and everything is just easily maintained, but you've had to fight for it just so much harder.
Yeah. When I was at the museum, starting in about 1985, we applied for government grants, and the largest grant we ever got from the Ontario Museum Association was about $4,800 for maybe a 2-3 year period, and then the government started cutting back on grant monies and changing the criteria, and you know, you couldn't get money for capital building and structures and all that sort of thing. So that made it harder. And then from the town of Amherstburg itself, we enjoyed a grant of about $1,000 for maybe 5 years. And, you know, the Trillium Foundation gives grants, which you have to be able to show you have sometimes 25% of the total grant amount or 50% of the total grant amount. And it would be wonderful if the museum got more grants from private people as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are prominent blacks in Canada, and to my knowledge, it may have happened since I left there in 2008, but I do not believe we ever had a substantial grant from any Canadian celebrity. And this is their history.
Yeah.
And white people, Canadians, organizations like the motor companies, and I'll get back to why I'm saying that, have never given substantial amounts either. Sometimes the unions, you know, will pay for a table at a dinner, which will come up to $1,000, $1,500. But one of the greatest inventors in North American history, and in fact globally, was Elijah McCoy. He was born less than 3 miles from where I live in Colchester South. His family and the neighboring settlers raised money and sent him to Edinburgh, Scotland to become an engineer. He came back to Canada, couldn't find a job, went to Detroit and worked in Michigan as a fireman on the railroad lines, and what they did was check the joints, the oil joints, and out of every day, an hour he spent stopping trains, oiling the joints so that they wouldn't seize up. Elijah invented the graphite lubricating system, several different patents, but the graphite lubricating pump that he invented made it possible for trains not to have to be wasting that hour. It allowed them to schedule. Can you imagine? You know how
Yeah.
And they were always late before then. There was no scheduling possible. He opened up the lumbering industry. That graphite lubricator was adapted to steam ships and cars. So Jennifer, every time we get in the car and turn it on, we should thank Elijah McCoy, a black man. And because of him, when other business people in the locomotive industry wanted the best, they would ask for the real McCoy.
Nice. That's where it comes from. That's amazing.
Right. So, you know, that's the trivia that I just read. I think it's important information. Our extradition laws are another example. A man who changed his name to John Anderson escaped from the United States, and in so doing, he stole a horse and injured his master, and the master died. He went to Guelph, Ontario. The master and several of his friends came up to Guelph to try and seize John and take him back to the United States. The community surrounded the jail would not allow John to be taken back to the United States. And his case went all the way to the High Court in Great Britain, and it was decided as a British subject not be extradited because his life was in jeopardy. As an American, which he was not, blacks were not American citizens, and as a slave, he was not a human being, and they wouldn't press charges against a dog, so why would they press them against him? So he was kept in Canada, and that's why our extradition laws are so tight. This makes me proud. This helps me to help you to understand that without black history, things would look very different. And my ultimate is Matthew DaCosta. He was a free black navigator trained at the School of Hendrick the Navigator in Portugal, which I visited. And he also was an interpreter. He steered the ship that brought Samuel de Champlain and the French to Canada. He interpreted between the Mi'kmaq tribes and the French. So that was 1604. That's his original documentation. He must have been here before if he could interpret the languages, right?
Yeah.
And even more important, because of his linguistic skills and his navigational skills, the French got a foothold in Canada, which started this new world. So, how great is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you actually coined the phrase, the black thread in the Canadian tapestry.
Correct. I did, because in Essex County, there is a tartan, and it has beautiful hues of gold for wheat, sky and water, red for the soil, and there are black lines that outline all of that, making it a beautiful tartan. And to me, that represents the black thread upholding the whole of the nation, the backbone, the low-cost slave machinery of the day that built this country. That's why I coined the black thread in the Canadian tapestry.
Yeah.
That's how my mind works. I'm an acquired taste. I realize that because I'm so focused on my passion. But it needs to be done.
Yeah, it does. We need it nowadays. I mean, the world is all at risk, and progress is, you know, there's always got to be progress and money being made and all that, and forgotten are the people, right? And all the sacrifices that were made seems to have been in vain when we are just throwing everything away nowadays, and nothing seems to have any value or much value, and as long as people make money, anything can be done.
That's right. Human life is a sacrifice. And the supposed victors are so busy promoting their own glory that they forget they didn't do it on their own.
Yeah.
It's the same for men and women. You know, we still have glass ceilings. That's what we change. We still get paid less for the same job. And taking that further, slaves got no pay, no recognition, and very little appreciation. And for people of any sort to be satisfied to live that way, to me, indicates insecurity. That everyone else has to be less than them in order for them to be prominent. That everyone else's contributions are not as important as the contributions they make, which is not true. It's a seamless evolution that people have been denying since ancient times. And moving forward from today, we have to start embracing each other, appreciating what each other do, no matter how small it is. When a child opens a door for you, that makes your exit easier. When a woman cooks you a meal, that satisfies your hunger. When any baby is born, they have the potential of being the greatest person on earth, no matter what color or gender they are. And that is what really honestly fuels my heart. I'm just as good as anybody else. My children are better than me. My grandchildren are absolutely supremely wonderful. And I know that you feel the same way.
Yeah.
And anyone who says any different or tries to make it any different, the economic slavery that we are involved in today is terrible. We have really digressed from the 1950s and 60s when you can walk down one single block and get three or four jobs. And now I know people with BAs and PhDs who've put out hundreds of applications and never even gotten an interview. What's going on?
Yeah.
It makes no sense whatsoever. There's enough, particularly in Canada. When I was a young girl, each Canadian was assessing 1 square mile of this country. And I don't think it's much less now because our population has not grown maybe by another 10 million since I was a young girl. And there's so much potential for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Stepping on other people's necks makes absolutely no sense. Other people of African origins who come to this country do not know about me and my history. And so they think they're making the history. They're making present-day history. But they did not make the history that made this country an open and accepting country to them.
Mm-hmm.
I could just go on and on, Jennifer, you know. Any subject matter, any trade, any accomplishment you'd like to mention, I probably can parallel some portion of Black history. I have deliberately done that my whole life. I've read thousands of books. I have a library of probably 3,000 books myself, largely dedicated to finding little teeny nuggets of Black history that I can insert in mainstream history and make it a better story.
Yeah. Well, your book that I have, which is the Black Presence in the War of 18 and 12, that's a phenomenally written book. Like, just opening the first page, this is the kind of book that should be in the classrooms as well, because it's adding that missing piece. And you don't only talk about the Blacks, you talk about the Natives in there. Like, your book is very well-rounded.
Well, yes, because you have to. You have to know a lot of history to insert the minority parts. Eurocentric history is wonderful. It's fabulous. Greek mythology. I just ate up. I gobbled it up. I love that stuff. But I had an aching need to see my own people's history presented in a positive, proper light. We were not just slaves. That was not our only ugly moment in history. And even as slaves, we did some phenomenal things. And we need to be credited for it. You know, like any child in such a conflicted state, I tried to unravel these interpretations. How can you stand there and tell me that all my worth is wrapped up in being a slave, and that I never did anything of any worth at all? That is not true.
No.
When I lecture in the United States, starting back in the 1980s, I started saying that I felt all African Americans should be given freedom papers. Papers that state they are free in their hands so they can look at it and believe it, because many of them still don't. And I feel that that's one of the reasons that there is so much black on black crime, because they don't value each other. There's a penal system that, in my opinion, was formed to keep black people down.
Yeah.
The things that they do, they get harder sentencing for. They spend far more time in prison. And when police are trying to resolve cases, they'll often pick somebody black. And we're hearing of so many different people who spent half their life in prison now being released because of DNA, thank God, that they didn't commit the crime.
Yeah.
It's a mentality, Jennifer. It's a systemic form of thinking that is costing and dangerous. And until they eradicate that, we're going to see more triple on margins. We're going to see more black people being shot because somebody thought they had a gun. And we're going to see more white families losing what they have too, because this economic slavery is affecting them as well as us. It's the whole mentality is degrading the great United States of America, and they need to be careful, because once Rome was the leader of the world, and because of their internal separations, they fell also.
And I
wouldn't want to see that happen. You know, they elected a black president, Barack Obama, and they have disrespected that man. There have been numerous threats against his wife that they don't talk about, because he's trying to keep a courageous face, which I think he has done, and improve the state. This Obamacare, as they call it, you know, if you don't have your health and you don't have access to things that can improve your health, it's a pretty sorry life.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's privilege that has made that happen. And again, it goes back to slavery. And again, it goes back to, where did you bury your slaves? I went to Mount Vernon, George Washington's home, and took a tour. This was in the mid-80s. And I asked, where's the slave burial ground? They were showing the vault with the tombs of members of the Washington family. And the lady looked at me and she says, well, it's somewhere out there on on the other side of the fields where the cows graze. We're not really sure. Well, they found it, Jennifer, and they now dignified it.
Good.
Was it because I asked that question and maybe somebody got the idea that, oh my God, that's wrong?
Yeah.
I hope so. It's that kind of being a catalyst for positive change that just nourishes me, that keeps me going. I recently was awarded the Carnahan Award from the Ontario Historical Society for long-time preservation and promotion of Black heritage in Ontario. That makes me very proud.
Yeah, congratulations. I was reading about that, actually. That came up in my Google search.
Well, I thank you. And, you know, the computer has helped a lot, too, because you can do Google searches, and you can think about almost anything and go on there and find something that might click in your brain or stick in your heart to improve whatever it is you're passionate about. I'm sure you've found things on horses.
Yep.
Use of horses, the safeguarding of horses, because I agree with you. Horses really made the world what it is today, too. They improved it, and then the motor car came along, and they, quote, quote, were no longer necessary.
Yeah.
Yes, they still are. And when slavery ended, I didn't become obsolete either.
No.
And I talk in a personal way, because it's about my people. So therefore, it is about me. It's very personal. It's very intimate. I wake up with it every day, and I go to sleep with it every day. And every day I walk out the door and someone sees me. They see my black face. And I'm proud of it. And so I promote.
Yeah, it's an important task. And nowadays, I mean, just even recently, there's been a lot of talk because, again, we have police violence, and we just touched about it, you and I, too, police brutality and things that we maybe think we have moved beyond. When it comes down to it, we haven't, because there's still, in some ways, segregation and less opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of ways, we are all so much at risk.
That's right. You're very right. And in harder economic times, it always rears its ugly head more prominently. You know, talking about Black Lives Matter, all lives matter.
Yeah.
But if you don't respect Black lives, what makes people think you're going to respect any others? There's the point.
Yeah.
And people should be very, very attentive to what is going on, because just like Kristallnacht before the Second World War, when the brown shirts were smearing propaganda across Jewish homes and then the Holocaust happened, do you not think it can happen again? It can happen again.
Yeah, for sure.
And we can all be enslaved again very easily, because rich, the robber barons of the world want more and more and more, and the only way to get more and more and more is to take. And if enslavement happens again, they'll have to pay millions of people to be the machinery.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have to pay millions of people to do all sorts of tasks that they have to pay for now. And they would like that. They would like that. So we need to really be vigilant. And that's why I promote my history the way that I do. Because I don't want to see my black grandson as a statistic. Mm-hmm. And I do not want my grandchildren, great-grandchildren, to be owned by anybody. So those are frightful things. I mean, as a
Yeah. Exactly.
And we have similar circumstances, no matter what our color or our gender, and we need to be starting to be more positive, even if we are hungry, or especially because we are hungry. It's so hard to find a job. I'll give you a meal. I'll let you stay with me. We do not do that because I'm black. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. It's our humanity that we have in common.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. When you meet a person, I know you don't judge them by the color of their skin. Why should anybody? It holds people back from receiving the rich contributions that I can give. I'm going to say this, it's the first time I've ever said it. What if I had never existed?
I know.
My contributions would not have happened. My determination and my drive to make a better world would not have taken place. That frightens me. I want to contribute. I want to make this a better world. And I especially want Black history to take its place in all of history so that we can welcomed flow of what history is about. Not man. History.
Yeah.
I'm working hard at it every day. My latest book is the biography of a black man who has been in hockey for over 60 years. And once again, it's a story where Europeans supposedly created hockey, although Indians lacrosse and black people hurley on the base of Nova Scotia were played. And we've had great hockey players, black hockey players like Billy O'Ree, Grant Fuhr, P.K. Subban, and P.K. Subban. Where's their history going to be? About a book a week ago that was written in 2015 about 100 years of thrilling hockey. There's not one mention of blacks playing hockey, and there are only two black players who are not identified as black in the whole book. The editing of history has got to stop.
Yeah.
I'm trying my hardest, and I will continue to do so until the day I die, to write positive, informative material that gives us a better handle on what this world has looked like and what it should look like in the future. That's me in a nutshell, Jennifer.
I like it.
That's what I'm glad that you do.
Yeah.
I do too.
I'm so old. I know, right? That's so awesome.
And I do African Heritage Cemetery tours. Generally can get to about 8 cemeteries in a day and also offer a meal to the participants and, sell my books, which is a benefit to me, I admit. But I love that. I teach Elder College, which is a process through the University of Windsor and Canterbury College, to help educate seniors, people over 55. A lot of my old professional friends have taken my courses, and I've taken theirs as well, because it's on any subject matter you can think of, from repairing cars to opera to black history. And that's given me ideas to write other booklets, at least. But my goal is to combine these into a book that makes good sense and really, really highlights black history the way it should be done. I just enjoy myself. I just find so much pleasure in everything I do. I never had a job I didn't like, you know, I didn't have to scuffle and go to something that I hated every day. I loved every minute of it. And meeting people like yourself is such a benefit to me, because other passionate people, doesn't matter what their passion is, it's comforting to me to know that there are people out there who really believe in what it is they're doing, and it supports me. Makes me feel normal. Whatever that is.
Yeah. I agree with you. It's like when I notice that somebody really has a heart, then I think, wow, I'm very grateful. Because you see too much of the opposite, where people are greedy and it's negative or short-sighted or just so ignorant. Then when people have a heart, I just go, oh my gosh, I love it. And you're right, with the passion too. I'm attracted to people with a lot of passion because I engaged with people like that.
Right. And when I was at the museum, and we would book school tours, and I would always ask if there were black students in the classes that were coming, because my process was to research their names if I didn't already know them. That's one of the beauties of being from a community for a long time. And when they got to the museum, I would present them with information about their families. Number one, to build their knowledge. Number two, to highlight them in front of their schoolmates that their families accomplished something.
Yeah.
More than running from slavery. That's a huge thing.
Yeah. Is it ever?
Yeah. And also to give them a better feeling about themselves and hopefully encourage them to continue their education and make something of themselves in a way that would positively impact society. You know, little small things like that can make such a difference. I had one young guy who worked at the museum in the summers for about 5 seasons running. He's now a designer. He's designed costumes for the WA, the wrestling world. Costumes for Madonna.
Oh.
Yeah, you got it.
Cool.
Exactly, because he got a better understanding of himself. A lot of the young black people, they're not so young, they're in their 50s now, who got government jobs where there were not people in those echelons previously, worked at the museum. And I would always have them write a report of how they felt the museum impacted themselves and instances of where they saw the museum impact other people, and give that to the board, put it in our annual reports. It's all pride building. It's all nation building, you know? That's what everybody should do in their own field. Make people more aware, give them an opportunity to experience it, and then also give them the voice to give that information and pass it along, pass it forward. That's the only way we're going to break the prejudice and ugliness that exists in this world.
Mm-hmm. You need to have a lot of self-confidence. Like you were saying before about when like to do with ignorance and to do with racism, like the lack of self-esteem that people have, like what you're talking about is the opposite of that. Like you have to be secure in yourself to promote others. You have to care about others and not feel threatened, because in fact helping somebody else, or just even I guess encouraging their own independent thinking, like that's real teaching right there.
Well, yeah, it is, and it's comforting to me. It continues to build my self-esteem, and it continues to allow me to think of other ways to continue to build beneficial. And regardless of how other people try to put you down, eliminate you, you're going to make it. And you're going to help other people to make it too. That's really nourishing.
Yeah.
I have never in my life feared death. I worked with hospice in the late 70s and helped to establish welcoming Black people into that process because they were a little bit hesitant because they didn't feel that they would be given the same sort of care which they were. When I worked in the hospital, I dealt with physician staff complaints. One physician had broken a nurse's finger because she was light-skinned and had funny-colored eyes, and she made him nervous. Where do people get these ideas?
Mm-hmm.
Again, it goes right back to systemic thinking and enslavement and how they can use an individual as a tool, treat them like animals, and at the very best perhaps. A lot of families I know escape from slavery as family pets because they would rather be free with little or nothing than be all dressed up with a silver chain around their neck. We've seen those pictures, the actual pictures. Nobody wants that. You know, it goes beyond the pride and promotion and preservation of my people's history. It speaks to improving all of mankind and taking it right back to the very beginning of Jennifer. They found the first skeletons in Ogilvy Gorge in Africa. So we all have that in our DNA. We're all from Africa.
Yes.
So it's not about the color, it's about the content.
Yes.
And when we can get to that and respect that, it's going to make the world a better place. You don't have to be prejudiced. You don't have to put anybody else down in order to get what you want and be the best at something. Just be yourself. Just believe in yourself, like you're saying. Have self-confidence and self-will and self-direction. And don't let anybody else stand in your way. And if you are self-confident, you very seldom have others stand in your way. Or come up against a brick wall that you can take your jackhammer and knock down. They will not stand against you.
Thank you. That is like amazing words.
Well, it's just my heart. It's how I feel. When I do these interviews on radio or television, I try to present myself in the best light possible. Not because I'm afraid, but because I'm confident that I'm saying something that is worthwhile, that I'm doing something that will make a difference. I might not see the result in my lifetime, but I have every confidence that what I do, what I say, and how I promote myself and my people will make a better world.
Well, it already has.
I will agree with you. But I don't want it to be just for me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want it to be just, well, you know, Elise Harding Davis came into this world and changed it for herself. A lot of things I do, I don't get any money for. I don't get any financial benefit from. The benefit I get is knowing that I'm doing it for a higher purpose. And I eat every day. I struggle sometimes, but everybody does too. That's what life is. Nobody ever promised any of us that we would be living the best of lives and the best of places with the best of everything. But remember, where you are and what you have at any given time is the best. And it will get better if you try.
Mm-hmm.
I am a proud Black woman. I'm a proud Canadian. And I will, till the day I die, promote my culture, my people's accomplishment, and Canada's prowess in the world because of it. That's how I see it. That's the way I slice it. I've worked for a member of Parliament and been able to assist him in going out on speaking engagements when he wasn't in the community, running the office, helping people who really, honestly were in dire straits to get on a better footing. The staff in that office were phenomenal. In fact, our office was known throughout the quote-unquote MP circuit, and they would call us to talk about resolving issues and things, and we were always happy to share. That's the thing of it. When I learn these little nuggets of Black history, I don't keep them to myself. When I see inequities, I don't keep them to myself. It's all about moving forward. It's all about eyes open, heart open, hands open, and progressing positively. You know, so many of us are so scared that if we get something, somebody might take it from us. That's not what you should focus on. You should focus on the fact that you have the ability to get something. And then enjoy it. So many people don't enjoy anything. Because they're always stressed out. Striving for more. And striving for better. Not appreciating the moment. I appreciate my Blackness every single day. Like I told you, I step outside that door and whoever I meet or come across, I'm who I am. And I'm not going to back down from it or stifle myself or allow myself to feel degraded just for anybody else to feel better. But I will help people feel better if I can. Doesn't matter who they are. A kind word, a kind gesture. Seeing somebody hungry, buying them a meal. Seeing somebody who was even conning you. Still giving them a dollar and saying, I hope that helps you. Maybe it will wake them up. Maybe they'll appreciate that that dollar came from somebody who cared about them.
Yeah.
That's a big problem, too, you know. People don't care. And as a little girl, I kept seeing these instances and putting my hand up in class and being told to put my hand down. They had already heard about Josiah Henson. Police step outside the class because it's disruptive for you to keep giving information that isn't valid to course you're taking. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. I've lectured in many, many universities. I've lectured in many consulates. I've talked to one person in a basement, and I've talked to thousands in lecture halls. It's all the same to me. I'm talking to you. I know other people are listening. I want you all to understand that I respect you as people. I respect really appreciating that friend, really finding out about that person. And then maybe stepping out of your comfort zone.
Can I see something?
And when he's insulted in public, standing up.
He wants to say something, so I'm going to add him onto air. Here, hang on a second, okay?
Hi there. Yes, it's Aleem from the Aleem Show here. I just did a radio show on kindness before that, before Jenny came in here. So I'm helping her record this interview so that we can go ahead and put this on soundfm.ca because this is so important here. I also just want to say here there, is it Elise, right?
Elise, yeah.
I also just wanted to say here that I used to live in Windsor, Ontario myself. From August 2011 to April 2013, and it was such an honor. I met a couple of people that were of African descent, but they were actually born in Canada. And I have to say that the story that you're telling as well, I have to say that I am so inspired by that story because when I used to live in Sarnia, I knew a gentleman by the name of, his name was Bill Simpson, and he was from Wallaceburg, Ontario, and he mentioned that in Chatham area, that with the Underground Railroad and everything, that there's a 50% population of blacks in Chatham as well, and I mean, is that true as well?
Yes, it is. Sometimes you don't know who you're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
African Canadians are very mixed. Like with myself, I'm telling you, I'm a seventh generation Canadian. My family's been in Canada since 1798. That means from 1798 until today, my family's been born here. We're Canadian. And in Chatham, the same situation exists. And back in the 1790s, and we'll take it back further to the 1600s when the colonies were being settled, the men came. There were not that many women. When they imported slaves, black women in particular, they bred them. That created a mixture, and we are unique North American product. I had my DNA done. I am 43% African, 27% Native American, and 27% European. I don't know anybody, and I mean anybody, of African descent who's been here like I have.
So amazing.
Because they were the women that were available.
Mm-hmm.
Now they tried to cover it up and say, no, we never had children by slaves like with Thomas Jefferson. How do we look like we do if they didn't mix with us?
Mm-hmm.
I totally agree. I mean, the one thing is that the pleasure that I had when I lived in Windsor was I met people who were like seventh generation Canadian, sixth generation Canadian that were actually born in Canada when I lived in Windsor. Like I used to like I know this one lady that works at, and I'm not gonna mention any names, but she works I met her at the casino, and she actually told me that she's half white, half black. And I mean, I was so amazed. I was like, you know what? What this guy Bill Simpson in who's from Wallaceburg, I knew him. I knew him when I worked at a call center called NCO in Sarnia. And the one thing is that what I was so amazed by what he said was this entire story. And I'm like, you know what? When I was moving to Windsor, I was so amazed that, you know, I was able to learn about this history as well. I should have gone to the Heritage Museum and stuff. Like, I mean, I'm so fascinated by learning about everything of this nature.
Jennifer's been trying to put together a bus tour to come down here. Wonderful for you to come with her. And I can take you to several of these different sites so you can improve your information.
Actually, this guy's name was Bill Simpson. Yes, he's actually, he lives in Wallaceburg, but he worked in Sarnia at the UWO Research Park.
Yes, well, the Simpson family have been in Canada on record since 1793, and I'm sure he's a member if he's African-Canadian. And the founder of the museum in Amherstburg was named Melvin.
Melvis Simpson. Oh, that is so. That
so
is so
probably
cool.
Probably related, and you know, again, here's our story. Here we've been here forever. We've welcomed so many other people into Canada. You have no idea how many people I've talked to in my lifetime who were immigrants who said when they came to Canada, the first meal they had was in a black person's house when they came to the city of Windsor. That's how we are.
I agree. I used to live in Windsor, and I actually found that so much. Like, you know what? Yes, you know, some people may not be welcoming, and that's anywhere in the world. But when I lived in Windsor, people were so welcoming. I have to say, like, when I actually came there, I was so amazed.
Yeah, well, Essex County is a big, small town. By that, I mean, we've all been here a long time. We know each other. When people come into our communities, we welcome them because we want them to enjoy what we enjoy. We want them to appreciate that we can all experience a level of freedom that is comfortable for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, becoming a Canadian here is the best it gets. I used to go to citizenship court and talk to people when they were receiving their Canadian citizenships, and I would say, you know, the whole world wants to come to Canada to experience the freedom that black people got when they escaped from slavery. That's what Canadian freedom is based upon, as far as I am concerned. Be unmolested, be able to live.
Hello and welcome to.
Live in your own home, educate your children, and nobody bothers you. And you don't have to be fearful of the police. You don't have to be fearful of the authorities. You don't have to be fearful that your next door neighbor is going to harm you. That's what we largely enjoy, definitely here, definitely. And as an addendum to talking about, I said to you, you don't necessarily recognize African Canadians when you see them. I have a 17-year-old daughter, most beautiful girl you could ever want to meet, with blonde hair and blue eyes and white skin. And her mother, Jennifer, you know my color. Her mother's maybe a few shades lighter than me.
Yeah.
We don't ever know what our children are going to look
wow,
like.
Wow, that's incredible.
You
very
know,
incredible.
Yeah.
Every child I had, when I was in the hospital, they would carry past me looking for Mummy Davis. Mummy Davis, Mummy Davis, because they were so fair. You know?
Yeah.
Those little things can get at you if you let them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, I have to say, you're so inspiring. I mean, I just can't, you know what, I'm trying to hold my tears, but this is a very amazing story. And I have to say that we all need to be more kind to one another and not care about what other people look like. You know, I will give an example of what happened to me one time. I once asked a girl out on a date who happened to be Irish and Italian. And what she told me was is that I don't date people of your kind. Which, I mean, you know, people just need to stop being so prejudiced.
That's how you see the world. You don't don't let other people's fears and concerns cause you to doubt yourself or cause you to miss out on your best self.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That girl, whoever she is and wherever she is today, may be very sorry that she didn't take the opportunity to date such a nice person as you.
And no, and I agree. I mean, I remember I can say the same thing. Because I'm East Indian and African of descent myself. And the thing is that I'm actually born in Canada, so I was born in Sarnia, Ontario. But the thing was is that I remembered when I was growing up, and I mean, I will be quite honest here. For me, actually, you know, I said to myself, like, you know, like with all the things I hear on the media and, you know, how the East Indian culture is, and, you know, just learning, I found when I was growing up, my parents were very old school, and, you know, just the culture itself was very old school. I said to myself, I'm never going to date someone of my own nationality. I said that, and you know what? I'll be honest. I had, you know what's funny? These two guards that I knew at Caesars Windsor, you know what they said was, is that, I mean, you know, one of them said to me, well, that's just stupid, you know what, you can't, like, you know, you can't be prejudiced, right? And the same thing this other lady told me, who I was telling you was half white, half black, she's like, you know what, we all have preferences, but, you know, by having, you know, preferences, it's, you know, you're better to be open, you know what I mean? And this other lady I know, she works for Grand River Transit, she's a bus driver. You know what she told me? She's like, now what happens if you meet someone of your own nationality that is super nice? Are you going to say you're not going to date them? So the thing is that, you know what? We just need to be kind to one another and just look at the person itself.
That's correct, because love knows no color.
That's right.
We can't help where our heart leads us, and we shouldn't.
No.
It takes a long, with all this hatred, a lot of people have been, you know, like as Jane Elliott once said, that when it comes to the hatred that, you know, you're not born with it, you're taught it.
That's right, that's true. Babies are innocent and they are made ignorant. That's what I feel. They learn that at their mother's knee, they learn that at their father's side, and it's detrimental, because what it does is limit you, it boxes you, it makes you unable to think and live outside of the box and enjoy rare and exotic things that can make you have a better life. It's really unfortunate. I tell people you shouldn't be prejudiced because you're limiting yourself.
Yeah.
And I agree, and it's like, I have to say, the one other thing I learned a lot when I lived in Windsor as well was, I went to a Swiss Chalet one time at, Tecumseh, in the town of Tecumseh, and I was waiting for my meal, and there was a gentleman that we were talking about multiculturalism one time, and he was saying that, and what a lot of people don't know is, Windsor and Essex County has been more multicultural than Toronto.
Yes, it has. In the 1950s, we had over 120 different cultures represented in Windsor Essex County. That's huge. Toronto was not that multicultural at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And we have more now. And we don't make a point of it. We make it an enjoyable thing. We have the Multicultural Festival. Did you ever go to the Multicultural Festival down at DF Park, where they would have different booths with all the different communities and also the different community centers and ethnic churches would open their doors for people to come and visit? We do that for 2 weeks in Windsor.
Well, I have heard of it. Unfortunately, when I lived in Windsor, I worked at a hotel. I worked at Days in Windsor, so I worked at a hotel, so I was working nonstop all the time, right? Like, I was always working all the time, and yeah, so I never had too much of a chance, but the thing is that I once went to an anticipation festival, which is the one...
Emancipation.
Sorry about the mispronunciation.
Yeah, no, it's okay, because I know exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, my dad wired the Emancipation Celebration every year and took care of all the electrical stuff. And I actually got my first bank account because of the Emancipation Celebration when I was 6 years old. Dad came home with two bags, two brown paper bags full of money, and he said, Elise, if you can count this properly, you'll get 10%, which I did. Thank you very much. And every year, after the celebrations were over, the first 2 weeks of September, I missed school. That's when we would take our vacation. Number one, because Dad made good money at the celebrations, but number two, because that was no longer the summer season, so things were less expensive. And we would go up through Ontario. He would take me, well, we have family members in Buxton, through Chatham, Dresden, my grandmother was born there, up into Oro Medonte, to the Black Settlement there, the Oro Church is there, into Owen Sound, and then up to the shores of Georgian Bay to visit the Collingwood community, the Sheffield family. They have a fabulous museum up there that everybody who has an opportunity should go and see. And, you know, like, this was my backyard, and I knew history from here to there. And one of the things I'm most proud of, the Nazaree African Methodist Episcopal Church at the museum site was the first site dedicated to Black history and the history of this country in 1999. They had been giving National Historic Site designation since 1920s, and we had none. We partnered with Parks Canada, the national park system in the United States, and at that time, this was 1998, there were only two national historic sites dedicated to Black history in the United States, and none in Canada. So you can imagine, I mean, I've lived through such a rich, rich evolution. Here in Canada, we now have at least 15 national historic sites, plus Black people as national historic heroes, including Josiah Henson, and I'm working on Elijah McCoy. You know, I'm going to say this to you, my friend. If you lived in Sarnia,
yeah.
At least one of your parents was very intelligent because you were probably associated with the companies there, Shell Oil, all those different places. So you've enriched this country through that.
Well, my dad used to work for Ontario Power Generation quite a while ago.
There you go. Just like me saying, you know, my dad did repairs on the Parliament building. That's big stuff for both of us. We can be proud of that. And they did that because they wanted us to have better lives. And I'm sure that your father could tell you stories that didn't make him too happy sometime, but he kept on doing what he was doing to make a better life for you.
Absolutely. I know this one driver, he's a bus driver, and he said that what he does is when, like this gentleman I know, how he handles situation, like when he gets, like, he's told me that he's been called racial slurs and stuff like that. And what he has done and how he's handled it, he says just thank you.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I am. It's not my problem, it's yours. Because I've been called racial slurs and I've been, quote, put in my place. I was lecturing at the Canadian Consulate in Chicago, Illinois, and I was very excited to be doing it. First time I had been in a Canadian consulate in another country. I had on a burgundy suede suit, which had cost $800, and shoes to match, and real gemstones, amethyst to match. I was looking real good. This lady came up to me and asked me to get her a drink. And I directed her to the bar, and when everyone convened for the lecture, she was sitting first row, first seat by the aisle. And the commentator came up and introduced me, and I stepped up to the podium, and her jaw dropped. And after I was finished speaking, she came up to me and she said, "You have perfect diction." I said, "Well, in my home, Queen's English was spoken. My mother didn't allow slang or slurring or any sort of thing." And she said, "And frankly," and this was the point she really wanted to make, "when I heard that somebody was coming from Canada to talk about the Underground Railroad and slavery there, I thought they were either going to be white or very fair. How did you get to be Canadian?" Because my family fled, possibly from your family, and went to Canada, freed themselves, and stayed black.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, the thing is that, you know what, I've even had to learn that too. I mean, you know what, nobody should ever have to take anyone that makes comments of that nature in any way, shape, or form. I mean, you know, but the thing is that we can't change other people's ignorance, but we can't.
Well, I call it innocent ignorance. Well, they don't know they're ignorant.
Yeah.
Or if they do know they're ignorant, they don't know to what extent they're ignorant. You know?
Yeah.
And it's better to listen and give them a good education than get mad and ruin an opportunity.
Yeah.
I agree. You know what? I think a lot of people today, what they do, and I mean, you know, I'm not trying to denounce or dispute or deny anything whatsoever, but what some people do now is they go to the Human Rights Commission and they complain and stuff like that. That's what people do today.
That's right, and it doesn't go very far, truthfully. The Human Rights Commission was instituted in 1961 because there was absolutely prejudice in Canada, and we had our civil rights era and all the rest of that, too. That's a whole other conversation. But there should be no need for that. If I don't appreciate and respect you, you just tell me. You help me understand that you're just as good as I am, that your hair is just every bit as wonderful, and that you have self-confidence in yourself. And then I've learned something. And then I can pass that along. Did you know such and such a thing? Did you know? Are you aware of? That's what I do on a daily, regular basis.
That's the best way to do things. I mean, you know, communication and openness is extremely important. And I mean, you know, I think the thing is that a lot of people today, whether if it's Canada or the United States, I should say, is we're so scared of offending someone when really we should be talking and having communication. Because I know in Europe, in like European countries, a lot of European countries, African countries, and I think India as well, and China and a lot of other places around the world, a lot of Eastern cultures, I should say, they'll just speak up.
Right. That's correct. You know, I've held awareness classes for discrimination and prejudice with 2,000 staff at Hotel de Grace Hospital in Windsor, where I was the discrimination officer, the executive director, with Mounties, with the OPP. I've worked with police throughout Ontario to have less biased hiring practices against minorities, women, disabled, and Indigenous people. Just seems like everything I do, I end up in a position, in a delicious position, of having the opportunity to race relations.
Oh, absolutely.
And you know what? When we talk about race, there's only one race, the human race.
I agree. That's what Jane Elliott says as well on that. Absolutely. I did have one question for you, though, because I know the chief of police in the city of Windsor, his name is Al Frederick. He's been talking about...
What's his name?
Al Frederick?
Al Frederick.
Yeah, he's the new chief of police. I mean, and he was saying about hiring more people of diversity. And there was one article in the Windsor Star that said that he says that diversity is the goal, even though in one of his hiring classes he hired all white people. And I mean, that's not, I mean, you know, I have to say that, you know, they always look for the best qualified people. But my question is how is his progress when it comes to hiring people of different cultures? Because I know the Windsor Police doesn't have as much diversity, according to the papers. Now, I mean, I'm not, now I can't speak on that, but I mean, I know you said you were working with the police departments on that.
I was working with the police back in the late 80s through the 90s for 12 years in different processes. But the constable selection process lasted for about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the materials, programs, things that we were presented with had been based on white men aged 20 to 45,
mm-hmm.
usually 6 feet in height, with a high school education.
Yes.
Well, that eliminated a whole lot of people. We changed a lot of those criteria. And when we started looking at minority women, the only comparison they had was United States, and I did not feel that that was appropriate. I said, start fresh, think for yourself. Canadian women are not American women. We don't have the same program and process here. A lot of the guys that I worked with, we would be put into different groups and presented with problems to solve. And behind my back, and it was, I'll say lovingly, they would come up with a solution, and no matter what I said, they would disagree. And I stuck to my gut. And when we ended that process, we had a dinner, and when I was walking out, those guys formed an honor guard out of respect for the fact that I didn't back down.
Yeah.
And that I had honestly and genuinely helped make a better process. Al is faced with a couple of situations. Policing overall has marching orders to try and mirror their communities in their hiring practice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in Windsor, that would mean about 3% black, 1% East Indian, maybe 10% Italian, and then the rest basically Eurocentric or Francophone. Well, he's had instances of reaching out to these different communities through the Multicultural Council, contacting people like me to see if we can recruit people from our own communities. And there hasn't been a lot of luck,
mm-hmm.
because of the prejudice that existed previously. I can tell you, I won't give you exact examples, but I can tell you that yes, there was prejudice in the police in the city of Windsor. Again, I'm calling it innocent ignorance, and I really think that I helped to improve some of that. And even amongst my own people, because it's also a prejudice to refuse to do something because of the way things are. When you have an opportunity to step in and improve it, you should do that. Right?
Absolutely.
You don't stand back and say, well, good luck, maybe somebody will step up. That's not what it's about.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I remembered I watched a video which was Windsor Police Stop a Bully, and And when they were saying, when they were asked, when they had a combination of people from the police department and from the community, they made sure that, you know, to include everyone of all different ethnicities and stuff like that. And that was an amazing video.
Everyone, amazing, amazing. Thank you so much for speaking with us here for about almost 2 hours.
Thank you so much.
I'm amazed that you would listen to me that long, and I'm really appreciative that we had such stimulating conversation today.
I know.
You know, you asked me good questions, you made good comments, your friend in the background there spoke up and really enriched the whole conversation, and I truly appreciate it.
Well, hopefully we can have you back on again with whatever else is coming up in your life and happening in Windsor, Puce area and all around there. And for sure, I want to organize a bus tour, hopefully next year in the springtime or whenever we're ready to head down there and go visit some cemeteries.
I will welcome you, and I also welcome the opportunity to speak to you again.
Thank you so much, Elise.
Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your day. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Cheers.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
And that takes us to just about the very, very end of the hour here. Blue Sky Horse Radio, we had a different topic today. It's a very important one, obviously. This is soundfm.ca or 100.3 FM here in Kitchener-Waterloo. Blue Sky Horse Radio, in general, race awareness for horses, questions regarding horses, wild horses, equine therapy. There's a huge focus on mental health, always trying to build a better community, hence why today we have the huge blessing and honor of speaking to Elise Harding Davis. And thank you, Alim, for your input. And
my pleasure. Thank you for having me here.
Anytime. And I hope you'll listen in next Sunday when the topic again will turn to horses.